You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Leslie Jones, and we talk about a decision she made almost 11 years ago to the day. This really might drop or release on the anniversary of this decision. She decided to drop alcohol from her daily life. So we talk about what inspired this decision for Leslie, how she feels about the concept of a rock bottom, the connection in her personal life between anxiety and alcohol, and how her life has changed as a result of making this decision. I think you're going to love this conversation, so let's do it. Leslie Jones, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat this morning?
Yes, I am so excited that I get to join you this morning and really excited to talk about the subject.
Yay! I start all of my questions, all of my interviews with the same question. What part of the world are you in?
I am in Dayton, Ohio, where I was born and raised.
Very nice. Very
nice.
Right in
the Midwest. Yep.
Yeah, right in the Midwest. All right. So next question, next warm-up question before we get to the topic of the day. This episode, we're recording this in October, but this episode is going to drop right at the start of 2026. And so I thought it would be fun to ask you how you feel about New Year's resolutions. Do you love them? Do you hate them? Not have a strong opinion either way? What's your feeling there?
You know, actually, I do have a strong feeling about New Year's resolutions. I usually try to pick a word every year to, like last year, my word was present. But ironically, the reason that we're talking today is about alcohol and sobriety, and how I got sober was setting a New Year's resolution on January 5th of 2015. So when this show airs, it will be about 11 years that I will have been sober.
Yeah, it could. I haven't fully set the schedule for January yet because I'm in charge and I get to do that. But it could actually drop. You and I talked about it before we hit record. This could actually come out on the anniversary. And that's super, super synchronous. Let's say.
Yeah,
let's use that fun
synchronicity.
That
would be very cool. Yes.
Yeah. So the topic of the day is about making that choice to ditch alcohol and get sober. And I love the timing of this because, as we just talked about, it's coming out in January. For a lot of people, that's just the end of a season of big indulgence, right? Like, so October starts with Halloween, and then we go into the fall holidays and then the winter holidays. And a lot of people come out of that, you know, in January, very full of cheese and mashed potatoes. And really, some people do use January as a reset time, so on and so forth. And you even just shared that you used this as a reset. So are you ready to talk about this?
Absolutely. Yes.
All right. Very good. So I was thinking about this as I was putting the questions together. I don't know that I've ever remember a time in my life, maybe college, but maybe not, where people weren't talking about sober lifestyle and sober choices. But I do feel like the conversation has maybe shifted in the past couple of years. And so maybe last decade, people are talking about it maybe more openly, maybe with it's just a choice sometimes as opposed to, you know, judgmentally. So let's talk about how long ago, and you mentioned that it was 2015. How long ago was this? How much time has been since you made this decision?
So it was January 5th of 2015, but so it'll be 11 years around when this show airs that I've been sober. But this was something that I've been thinking about for many, many years. I've done many New Year's resolutions where I was either going to do like a dry January or, you know, maybe I would not drink for 60 days or something. I've done a lot of experimenting with not drinking over the years. And I've always had sort of an unhealthy relationship with alcohol ever since I was, I started experimenting with it as early as seventh grade, if you can believe that. So, So I've kind of always known there was that I was a different kind of drinker.
How old were you in seventh grade?
I was 12.
Yeah. That's the number. It's interesting because you phrased that with, you know, if you can believe it. And I'm not an expert on this or
Yeah.
anything like that. But in the stories and the novels and the books that I've read, frequently 12 is a number that comes up, you know, where people start experimenting at that time. And
Yes.
I don't know why. So anyway, it doesn't. To me, it's young. It's definitely young, and I think that anybody who's an adult would agree that, you know, at 12 years old, we don't have the experience to make maybe the best decisions we're ever going to make. But also, I think that it's an interesting benchmark. You would have been in junior high or middle school at that point in the United States, which is
Yes, 7th
absolutely an
grade.
experimenting time. And I like the fact that you used the word experimenting for sobriety. I think that now one of the phrases we use, and I don't know if it'll stick forever, is that whole sober curious thing.
Yes.
People who are doing it, and it's a nice reframe because a lot of this is social packaging about how we show up in the world and what's acceptable in the audience of our community. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on for your experience with, you know,
Yeah.
your life and your community, right? So one of the things that appealed to me about the way you pitched this is that you shared that you didn't hit a rock bottom to make this decision for
That's
yourself.
right.
And I want to talk a little bit more about that. And I want to start with I like to the word rock bottom comes up when we talk about substance use, but I
Yes.
want to back up because I like to make sure that I don't assume that anybody who's listening knows what we're talking about. So go ahead, not as an expert, but just as a person, share what the words rock bottom mean to you when you're using them.
Sure. So when I think, well, I think there's what it means to me personally, and I think there's what it means to maybe a larger audience in the context of alcohol. So I think societally, the word rock bottom means someone who has lost a lot. They have lost a job. They have, because of their drinking or their drug use or whatever their vice is, they have lost a marriage. They have lost custody of their children. They have a DUI. Those are all things that you can quantify and that obviously are life-changing things. So the more down the scope you go, the more you lose and the more. And so rock bottom in that context is when you've lost so much and there's nothing else to lose that you have no other choice but to make a change in your life. So
Yeah,
I
and
think
that's a
that's.
right. That's a theory, or a that's maybe not the right word, but that's like a concept within some communities of sobriety that
Yes.
almost like it's necessary to
Correct.
go through that. Yeah.
And I struggle with that because I think it is a massive misconception. And I think it's why a lot of people keep drinking when they probably know they need to stop drinking. And I
Think that's
think that's
fair.
something I recognized really early was that I am a very competitive person. I don't like losing. And I knew towards the end of my drinking that I hadn't lost anything, but I knew the losing was coming. And every time I continued to drink, I was rolling a dice. And I always tell people, I really am, even though I've not lost anything, and everybody have, may have looked at my life. I've got a husband who I've had dated since 7th grade, a great job. I have several degrees. I ran marathons. I have 3 children. I had lost nothing. Inside, I had lost so much. I had so much shame around my drinking. And there's just this misconception that you have to start losing something before you quit. And I always say, quit before you lose because I hate losing. So I
Yeah.
did the quitting before I did the losing.
Yeah, I think that that's yeah, and I think that that's really interesting. And I love that you brought that up because the question I had in my mind is to talk when we talk about rock bottom, and we'll talk about what, like, you know, when you said, you know, what society thinks it is and then what you think it is. It sounds like what you're saying is that for you, the rock bottom was the awareness that if you kept going, there was the chance of the more and more likely chance that you were going to lose something big. But
Yes.
correct me if I'm wrong. Why, and talk more about why you chose that that was something that you wanted to share, like that you quit without hitting the rock bottom.
Well, because I think it keeps a lot of people drinking. I think that when we compare ourselves to other people, or what society thinks is an acceptable quantity of alcohol.
Yeah.
I wasn't an everyday drinker. I we didn't keep it in the house because I had always ha I mentioned I dated my husband, on and off through seventh grade. It had always been sort of a subject of, I wouldn't say contention, but there was an awareness there that it wasn't something that was totally healthy and something I didn't totally have control over, even though I had lost nothing. So I think it just keeps a lot of people that idea of rock bottom, of not losing something. It's not really what I came to realize after all my experimenting over the years with not
Yeah.
drinking is that it's not about the quantity at all of what you are necessarily drinking. Because I could even go, 30 days, 60 days, whatever. I could try to control it. I would make rules up. I'm not going to drink hard liquor. I'm only going to drink beer. I'm not going to drink wine because if I drink white wine, I drink it too fast and then I can lose control. Inevitably, the rule would be broken. And inevitably, and it may take 8 months, but I would get so intoxicated. And I would feel so much shame the next day that it just wasn't worth it. And then I just really thought, what is, there is no difference between me and the woman who leaves the bar and drives and hits and kills someone just because I, it's like this almost, it couldn't ever happen to me. And I just got to the point where I really felt like I was the same as the woman under the bridge with the paper bag.
Yeah.
I just quit before she did. And I'm
So,
so
and the
lucky that I
one of the
did.
things, and again, not an expert and not a substance counselor, but one of the things about the rock bottom thing that I find as an observer curious and confusing is that, if you describe it to people as a line that people will cross, there are people who live in the state of rock bottom, or who their lives are in a way that, they have a lot of societal judgment. So let's take the stereotypical case of the person who has lost or never been able to gain everything. They have no home. They're living on the street. They are in a cycle of substance use. They've lost all those things. They continue at that state, and so it's not. It to me, it's confusing because if we present it like, hey, there's a point where you'll flip this switch and make the choice because there is no other way, I think there's evidence that there are people who don't. And so, like you're saying, it's like if you're waiting for crossing that line, it's not a guarantee that when you hit that you'll come back. You could stay in that point. And so I think that's a helpful reflection. And I think the other thing that, as an observer, that I'm hearing you say is really what you were doing is defining your own bottom. This is as far as I want to
Correct.
get.
Yes,
Yeah.
100%. And I think it's not really about how, again, the societal standards of what an alcoholic is or
Right.
what a problem drinker is. It's not really about that. It's about how you think about your drinking. So if it were, we didn't drink during the week, like I mentioned, we didn't keep alcohol in the house because it was a source of it was an issue. And if
And
it
when you say it
was,
was an issue, this means that this the people in your life, you were talking to them about it, like it was a something that was causing marital
No.
disagreements. No, or just
No, not
inside your own head.
necessarily. It was almost just like this unspoken thing, like we just don't drink during the week. We just don't drink during the week. That's
Okay.
just something we don't do.
Okay.
And so I knew we don't drink during the week. And it would be Monday, and I would already start thinking about Friday at 5 o'clock because I knew that was a socially acceptable time to start drinking, even if I wasn't getting intoxicated. The time and energy I spent thinking about drinking was, it was unbelievable. No one would know
Yeah.
it. I mean, I was still doing my day-to-day life. I still optically looked like I had everything together. And I'm telling you, I would think about drinking so much. What I was going to drink, when I
Wow.
was going to drink, when's the next, can I manipulate circumstances this weekend about being able to drink more to go to a party instead of just staying here for dinner or whatever? And that type of thinking is, it's really dangerous.
And that's another thing that has come into the discussion the public discussion space in the last 24 months. With Ozempic and all of the GLP diet drugs, one of the things they're talking about is the food noise, which is very similar to what you're talking about. This mental effort of like, when am I going to do this? What's going to happen? So on and so forth. And what's interesting to me, again, not an expert, not a doctor, didn't go to medical school. But one of the things that's super interesting to me about that, there's somebody in my family who took it and they immediately said, I don't, it's the most amazing thing. I'm not worrying about this, not thinking and not plotting about it. And so as an observer, one of the things that's so interesting to me is how it was completely disregarded by the medical profession until very recently. And now all of a sudden people are like, oh yeah, this is a thing that we should take seriously. And I think it rolls over into everything else. It's like, when, there's this invisible weight that you were carrying, that work of thinking about it and so on. So no one can see it, no one knows it's there but you. That doesn't mean it's not real.
Totally.
And the other thing that you mentioned that I think is really helpful, which most people I think have experienced, is the way we diagnose things, and I'm not a doctor in modern time, is like there's a book and a chart. It's like these are the five symptoms, and you only have this if you can check all these boxes, right? And I think that most of us have been in a situation where we're like, okay, I don't have all these boxes, but I feel like crap. What are we gonna do, right? And that's kind of what you're saying is like, I didn't check all of the boxes in the quiz in the magazine or the, the thing. And so, in a way, were you negotiating with yourself through this? Like, I don't know that I love this, but I clearly don't fit this. I don't match this
Absolutely.
title.
Yes, absolutely. I think the thing that really pushed me over, I mean, because it is gray. There is no, this isn't a black and white thing. You can't just check a bunch of boxes, say, I'm an alcoholic, and then get sober. That's just not how it works. And getting sober is not easy. If it were easy, everybody would do it. So I think, I really, you mentioned earlier about hitting rock bottom and that people, even though they hit a perceived rock bottom, they still continue to drink. And I really think this is what really convinced me to stop was I think the more you lose, the more down the scale you go with your drinking, the harder it is to crawl your way back. So I almost equate it. I've thought a lot about this. My mom had breast cancer and it was stage zero. So she still had to get a mastectomy, but it was easily treatable. She didn't have to have chemo and she didn't have to have radiation. And I really think about that with drinking. I think I quit drinking at maybe a stage one of a scale of, I'm sorry, that's my dog.
That's okay. Hello, doggy. I think everybody who's listening and watching knows that we are real people. So, Leslie's dog, for people who are listening, Leslie's dog just walked in and made an appearance
He
in the
did. That's
interview. So,
Lucas.
hello, Lucas.
He's a little Papillon. But yeah, so I think he's very protective of me. So he's always following me around. But yeah, so I think, if I would say I quit more at like a stage one, I hadn't lost anything. And so I didn't have all this shame and I didn't have to rebuild a life. So I think the farther down the scale, the farther, I guess you would say, the later stage in your drinking that you go, I think the harder it is to quit, which is why I think people that you look at, you're like, you've lost everything. Why are you still drinking?
So yeah, that is, I will say this, like, habit change and motivation and overeating and substance use, those are all in like those are all in a lot of the books like that I read about, self-development and all of these things. So like they frequently use some of these things as case studies and examples. And I'm not a person who researches these things. This is not my job, but I have read a bazillion books about these things over the years for a variety of reasons. And one of the things that comes up in these books, right, is the question of why, and people research these things, not me, why do people, not specific people, but people as a group, like human beings, why do we sometimes do things that we know are not great for us. Like, if there's somebody on the planet who doesn't know that smoking cigarettes is not healthy, right? It's not a health food, right? Doritos are not a health food. You know, alcohol is not a health food. French fries, right? I think we all know that eating fried foods, all of these things, and these are theories, right? I'm not presenting these as facts, but one of the questions is, why do we do it at all? Like, why do we do it? And one of the theories that gets bounced around, and I'm not presenting this as a fact, but just a discussion topic, is that the threat of the damage is not acute enough for us to take seriously. So it's like, someday I might get heart disease, but today I'm 16, and so it doesn't feel like it's a real threat yet. And that's, so to put in perspective, that's one of the things that they use is, it's like, when you get the diagnosis, like, you've got people who will smoke their whole life, try quitting, a million times and not be able to do it. But then the second they get the diagnosis and it becomes real, they quit with no problem. And very sadly, in that, situation, it's often too late to make to be able to walk it back.
I think that's actually how I got sober.
Okay.
So, can I tell a little anecdotal
Yeah,
story
tell
here?
it. Go for it.
So it was January 5th. I decided to do this New Year's resolution. I thought I was never going to drink again, but I wasn't totally sure. And I did 30 days sober. I was getting ready to go on a family vacation with a bunch of extended family, and there was going to be some heavy drinking there. I knew I didn't want to drink. I didn't know how not to drink. So I had one friend who was sober. This was before people really, I mean, this was, 11 years ago. I think we talk a lot more about sober, sober curious, sober being the new black kind of thing now. 11 years ago, it wasn't cool to be
Right. No,
sober. It
it
really wasn't. I
wasn't.
knew one
And
person in my early 30s that was sober. And I called her and I said, she had been sober for a while. I said, I think I really need to not ever drink again. And she said, I'm going to come over. There's a meeting. It's a women's meeting. It was a Friday. I was flying out to Florida on Saturday. She said, I'm going to come watch your kids. You need to go to it. And it was a noon meeting. And I walked in, and there I was so scared. I was like, who are these people going to be? Are they going to be, just a total train wreck? Are they going to be like me? Are they? And I walked in, it was all women. They were all just beautiful and gracious. And I saw a teacher in our community.
Okay,
And
somebody you knew.
I said, and she's beautiful. She has children. She's has it together. You would never know. And she came up to me and she gave me a big hug. And she was like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you were part of this. And I said, well, I'm not. I don't know if I'm in the right place. And I told her a little bit about my story, that I had toyed with this and how I thought about drinking and all of that, and how it took over so much of my mind. And she said, you're absolutely in the right place. That's exactly what got me here. She had been sober for 10 years. And she said, it's not yet. You haven't lost it yet. And that just stuck with me. And she ended up being my sponsor. I still talk to her. We lived overseas. She came and visited me over there. I mean, she really changed. It was a guy. I'm very spiritual, and I think that she was in the fact that she was in the room that day. She was supposed to be teaching, but for some reason it was Valentine's Day, and she got that day off. And it changed everything for me. That word, not yet, because that's why I don't drink today. It's why I didn't drink yesterday, and it's why I'm not going to drink tomorrow, because I know that I will lose. If I drink, I will lose.
It's so there's a couple things that you touched on there that I think are helpful, right? So, and one of the things, so the whole culture around sobriety and also often mental health type things is that there's value. There's like hidden society, like value judgments that are placed on the group of people who are, or historically they've been making these decisions. And I like to borrow from other places where we mysteriously have made the decision to not place that value judgment on the group. So, like in success coaching, right, it's super important. It's one of the best practices, right? If you want to be a good runner, go find a group of runners to support you, right? And we recommend that, right? You want to be a businessman, go to MBA, go to business school, find your group of people. But when we look at people who are trying to just this, who are, looking for a group, and the group support within sobriety, people have very strong opinions about the individual groups. Like,
Yes, they
it's like, I
do.
like this one and I hate
Yes.
that one. And that's like just a different conversation, right? And I don't have
For
a dog
sure.
in that fight. But I just want to offer that like cross framing that it's like the value of community when you're trying to behave, change your behavior in any way, like you want to become a vegetarian, or you want to just eat more broccoli, or you are looking for a job, or you want to start a business. That group thing, there's a huge amount of anecdotal re evidence that that is very helpful in making the
Absolutely.
decision. And so, but you talk very openly about the fear and the pressure of going to that first thing. What are people going to think? And that's the reason I wanted to borrow from that other group description to like sort of offer people a reframe of like, just think about it as, any of the things. Because I think people have that all the time. I've talked to people about that with Al-Anon. I've talked to people about that, family members who are doing it. It's like we're very concerned. And truthfully, I don't want to sugarcoat it. There are, even though we talk about sober curious, gray drinking, black and white, all of these things, there can be, with all of these situations, real societal implications of people who want to judge you for anything.
Oh, for sure.
People can be jerks. So, that's just not all people, but some people. Okay, so you do a 30-day thing. I want to talk about, you said something about you didn't know how not to drink, right? And I'm not gonna hammer that home. But one of the things that I've heard people talk about is, and this is where the question is gonna go, is that they're not sure what to do in certain situations, right, in their life, right? They just don't know. So like when you go now to like a barbecue, or you go to like a dinner party or whatever, give us an example of something. And the question is like, what do you do? What is a beverage today that when you go to like a barbecue, what are you going to drink in a social situation?
I mean, I drink a lot of Diet Coke, to be
There you go,
honest.
Diet Coke. All right, very
My
good.
kids get on me because they're like, "Mom, why do you drink so much Diet Coke?" I'm like, "Well, it's better than drinking other things, so everybody's got to have their vice." And I do drink a lot of sparkling water
And
too.
sparkling water, right? So then, yeah. So that's, and I just wanted to throw that out there as like a, like for, because it's like sometimes when we don't know what to do, right? It's like, it's very helpful that somebody's like, oh, this is when you lace up your shoes, right? This is like,
For sure. And I will caveat that with like the first year of sobriety was not easy. So I just really did avoid certain situations that I felt like I wasn't going to be totally comfortable not drinking, especially situations where there was heavy drinking. I just would go for 10 minutes or I just wouldn't go altogether, which did change really our social life quite a bit. There were some repercussions to that. Now after that first year, I don't think about drinking really at all anymore. It just doesn't cross my mind. It's just who I am. I just don't drink. But yeah, that first year, I mean, it's not like a switch flips and it's like, oh, I'm just gonna drink Diet Coke. It's definitely hard, especially that first year of sobriety.
So let's talk about how your life has changed. So you make this decision January 5th. About a month later, Valentine's Day, make the commitment to yourself that is a forever decision. And now, 11 years later, it's stuck. So congratulations to that.
Well,
'Cause
thank
like,
you.
any habits of any kind to make that switch. But this is one that has a lot of research that people say it's really, really tough. Let's talk about how your life has changed between since then.
I mean, gosh, I don't even know where to start. My life, maybe from the outside looking in, is still pretty much the same for, optically, other than our social circles a little bit different, but it just inside the walls of our house and just myself in general, I mean, it's really night and day. I'm so much more at peace and calm. I used to be really trying to control everything. I mean, I've always been kind of a type A overachiever type thing. I drank because of the anxiety. That's why I started in 7th grade. I mean, I literally remember the first time I got drunk and I was like, this is the best thing ever, because
Oh my
all
goodness.
that tension in your bones just goes away and you can just sink in and just, it's, you're just so relaxed. And for someone that's wound so tight, it was literally like life changing finding alcohol. And that's why I continued to drink until, you know, I got sober. It's why I loved drinking so much. It's why when it was Monday, I would think about it all week, because you're at home with three little kids and, you know, all you want is just to relax for a second. And
Yes.
the best way for me to do that, the only way at the time that I knew to do that, was to drink Friday at 5 o'clock. So that is huge. I'm just not that way anymore. I'm just not high strung like that. I'm Italian, so I can still fly off the handle, but for the most part, you know, I think my temperament is just much more even. I know how to handle life a little bit better. I remember, again, just anecdotally, this sticks out in my head because I think I'd been sober for like 90 days or something. And I remember it was in the morning and, you know, I had the two little kids and one of them didn't feel well. And I was all dressed. I think I was still working part-time. I was like dressed, ready to go to work. And she didn't feel well. She was sitting on my lap and she just vomited all over me.
A classic parent moment.
Right.
I just got to
It
say, it's
is.
like,
Yeah.
and you're like, this was not
Oh, God.
in the sales brochure.
No, exactly. Just all over, you know. And I just remember being so calm and just picking her up and taking her, putting her in the shower, and then just, you know, undressed, changing my clothes and handling it so calmly. And I'll never forget that because it was such a before and after moment for me. Like, had I been drinking, and just in that drinking mindset, I would have been so irritated and just not have handled it like that. I would have, it just would have, it would have ruined my day. I was so much more irritable just generally. So that just always sticks out in my mind. You know, it's such a good question. Like, how did your life change? And just even in those 90 days, I feel like I just was already so much more able to handle things that came at me that weren't planned.
So, as part of this, have you, is it just the absence of consuming alcohol, or have you also built in and learned and applied anxiety reduction management tools as sort of a side effect of this change?
Well, ironically, the anxiety subsides once the drinking's out of your life.
Okay, so
It's
it's
crazy.
related. Okay, all
Yes.
right.
I mean, I would be so if I got intoxicated or drank too much, you know, like to the point where I was really feeling it. And I'm not talking like blackout, but even just, you know, you're intoxicated, you're going to be a little hungover the next day or very hungover. My anxiety was through the roof. And
Yeah.
I'm telling you, all I could think about was drinking. All I would
Yeah.
want to do was drink. I was still at the point, you know, I talked about the stages of alcoholism earlier, and I think I was still at the point where I could like white knuckle it and
Yeah.
not drink. I think that there's a point, if you're later in the disease of alcoholism, you cannot, like, you lose the choice to not drink. I really truly believe you lose the choice.
Yeah.
And I still sort of had the choice and I was still able to white knuckle it and not drink and then wait until that anxiety. But all I could think of is all I want to do is drink. All I want to do is drink.
So, do you know who Rich Roll is?
I don't.
Okay, so he's an ultra runner and a vegetarian, and he has a podcast and he's written some books. I think now they might call him a motivational speaker. Anyway, so years and years ago, I read his book and his story about the first. He was older than you in this story, if I remember it correctly. I think he was in high school or maybe college, like maybe he went on a college trip kind of thing. And for the first time in his life, he had alcohol. And he describes it almost exactly the way you do, that it was a life-changing experience because he was able to relax for the first time. And so, you know, I think it's curious because anxiety is one of the things we're talking about more in 2025, 2026 than we ever have before. And that's why I asked the question of like, the anxiety techniques. I think it's really interesting because it's like there's always the question for me of like why, I ask people why they make the ch decisions, right? So it's like what is the thing behind the decision going on that's driving it? Like what makes alcohol the best choice? Because anxiety
Sure.
feels terrible.
It does. It's the worst. It really is.
Anxiety feels really, really bad. And so through that, and as a person, when I'm looking at that, like when I'm meeting other people, I try and always have that like sort of perception. I don't know what's going on in somebody's life and what the story is. I always assume people are trying to make the best decision they can. And that puts that in that lens. It's like when you are experiencing this horrible anxiety, and the only tool you have and the only tool you know works is wine o'clock. There's compassion there. There's compassion there because somebody has to present to you a different, or you have to discover a different option in order to make the different choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, and for you, one of the things that you mentioned is that you didn't hit rock bottom, but you were missing things in your life, and that was the thing that drove the decision that you were making. Talk a little bit more about that internal pressure that you were feeling, because I think that because it's invisible, because people were watching you from the outside, you still had a job, you had a house, you had a relationship, you checked all the boxes. Talk a little bit more about that invisible structure struggle that you felt like you were missing things already.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really shame. It's just it that's just what it is shame. You have this thing that you think about way too much. No one knows about it because no one can be in your brain and hear your thoughts. You're maybe drinking mostly like all of your friends. So it's not like you're standing out, but they're probably not thinking about alcohol the way that you're thinking about it. And I did know, and I did recognize this. I was very aware even in high school that I was drinking because of my anxiety.
Oh,
And
so
so
you were aware.
oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I don't say this as a way to brag. I just say it to put context to the story. So in 1998, I won with my sister, we won the Ohio State doubles title.
In
And
tennis
there in
or?
tennis, in
Okay, in tennis.
tennis,
Okay.
sorry, in tennis. And there
Could have been
was,
pickleball, could have
yeah, no,
been
it could have been pickleball. Yeah,
speed
in tennis.
skating,
Yes, no, in
figure
tennis.
skating,
Thank
yes,
you. Yep.
diving.
And there was a so they did, we're doing a new thing where they put there's like a flag with our name, not a flag, but a banner in the gym with our name. The whole community was invited because I think we were the first team to have won state in the history of
No, it's a
school,
big
whatever.
deal,
It's a big
yes.
deal, right? And the thought of that, so I was a senior in high school, the thought of that was so it was crippling to me. And so leading up to that, this is not my proudest moment, but this will tell you my relationship with alcohol. Leading up to that, I was like, there is no, and people were not talking about anxiety back then. So I kept all of that inside. My parents had no idea. They feel guilty now. And I'm like, you couldn't have known. I was so good at pretending. Like I was so good at hiding everything and just appearing to everybody like I had it all together and I was perfect and I had all the things. And I was like, I can't be down there. Our gym is a pit, so it's like below everybody. And then there's all these, it's a circle. And I'm like, I'm gonna be down there. I have to talk. Everybody's gonna be looking at me. I can't do this. Can I be sick? How can I do this? I started taking, so my dad had a refrigerator out in our garage and he drank Bud Light Ice. I don't even know. Do they still make that? I don't
I
know.
assume they do. I assume they do.
I mean, so gross.
These beers, frat parties when I was in college in the 90s had Natural Light, and I thought that that didn't exist anymore. And then in my 30s, I went to my stepson's frat party at my stepson's house, and I was like, oh my God, Natural Light, they still have that? And so it's like, I don't think these brands ever die. So let's just assume.
I just remember the ice was extra alcohol.
Oh,
So
okay.
I was like, it was like Bud Light ice. So it was extra concentrated. And so I went and I started like the 2 weeks leading up to it, I would just slowly like take them and hide them in my room. So I had several Bud Light ices ready to go for that day. This is like really embarrassing, but it's just the reality of it. And I mean, they were piss warm because,
You were in a
they'd been in
closet.
there for, and I was getting ready in my room. I mean, of course I was, just in a private room, and I just chugged them. I chugged them. And I knew, even at that age, I knew exactly how much to drink to get the feeling that I needed to feel, to be able to have no one know, but to be able to present myself in front of everybody.
Well, and they call it liquid courage, which,
Yeah,
like,
that's
so it's like it's
exactly.
socially acceptable. And you can, yeah, I don't, God, I don't know if they do this anymore, but in old movies, you'll see people like suggest it to people. Oh, you're going to go make this presentation, I mean, and things like that. So that is really interesting. I just, I'm sure that the, so, and I appreciate you sharing that story, vulnerably and humbly and all of those things, because I think it's helpful for people to see it. There's a well-known book, The Naked Truth. I'm spacing on the name, and she tells a story of that also, about drinking before she went on stage to make a business presentation. And similarly, to you, she's like, this may shock you, but I think that part of it that's so, that is equally, it's like we can never know what other people are doing because
No.
we're not them. One of the times I made that revelation was actually like teaching one of my kids how to drive, and I looked around and I was like, all of these people could be new drivers around me. You just never know who knows around you.
It's
It's
so
like,
true.
should never make the assumption that anybody around me has any idea what they're
No,
doing in this
I can
car,
guarantee you there's not one person at that presentation or whatever it was that knew that I had just chugged four Bud Light Ices,
That's a lot. That's a lot of Bud Light. That's a lot of Bud
Or
Light.
maybe
All
it wasn't
right.
four. It could have been three. It
No,
was
but
just enough,
yes, and you had a plan. All right. So in a second, we're going to do the final fun questions. You were talking about your personal story here, but we're going to segue just directly. That's, into this. We're going to do the final fun question in a second. Tell people about what you do as a profession, as your career, as your business now, and a little bit about that.
So, you mentioned the groups earlier and how support can help people that are struggling with different things. And I just am such a strong believer in that. And I think that we're here to connect. And I think that, just like we're doing today, to share our stories. Every January 5th, I share a little something about my sobriety, just because every time I do it, I get at least two people who read it and PM and DM me and just say, "Hey, I've been struggling, and can you help me? Or what do you think about this? Or what do you think about that?" And so I continue to share it because I do think that that's, people, it's just knowing that you're not alone. And so I started a company that I launched in 2022. It's called Traveling Pendants, and the whole basis of it is connection and sharing our stories. So they are pendants, and they say "Strength for the Journey" on them. They're all handmade, fine precious metal, and they have, right now they have QR codes on the back, so they're etched on the back. The whole idea is you scan the code, and then it's taken to you take you're taken to my website, where it's like sort of a story hub, and then you share your story of strength. Some people write a sentence, some people write a whole novel, some people upload videos and pictures, and then you wear your pendant as a source of strength. And when you're moved by someone in your life who needs strength, you pass it on to them, and they scan, and then they add their story. And then you can continue to track it as it travels around and read all the stories it collects.
All right. So Traveling Pendants is the company, and the website for anybody who's listening is travelingpendants.com. This is a business and a company that you've formed. You have a special offer for the audience, which is a 20% off discount for anything at travelingpendants.com. The information for that is that you use the code IMPERFECT on the website to get that 20% discount. For everybody who's listening and watching, the information on that is in the show notes or the video description, but the easiest way always to collect this information about the discounts from and special offers from guests is to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email list, because then it arrives in your inbox. You don't have to fumble for a pen or try and remember from the middle of your run or wherever you are. And you can just click on it. So that's a very generous offer, and it's a really innovative concept and idea. It reminds me of that book from a long time ago, the Traveling Pants.
Yes,
Yeah.
I get that a lot. The
But
Sisterhood
do
of the
you?
Traveling
Okay.
Pants.
All right. As you were telling the story, I was like, that book was so good, Traveling Pants. All right. So travelingpendants.com. Thank you very much for that very generous offer, Leslie. Are you ready to wrap this up with the final fun questions?
I hope so.
People get stressed about this, but don't.
Okay.
These are supposed to be rapid fire and just for fun. Don't put any stress. Okay, so do you have a set morning routine? And if so, do you want to share what it is?
I do, and it's kind of embarrassing that I still wake my children up every morning for school, and they are high schoolers.
That's fine. That's fine. I'm sure they appreciate it. One of these days they'll have to do it on their own, and hopefully they'll say thank you to you for doing it all the time for them. All right. Next one. Do you read or listen to books? And if so, do you have a recommendation of a recent book that you have read or listened to that you really liked?
That's a good question. I listen to a lot of podcasts,
Okay.
actually. I'm not so much a reader, so I do listen to a lot of podcasts, like a lot of self-help type stuff. I'm trying to think the name of the last book I read. I actually don't remember. Isn't that terrible?
It's not. I'm like that too. I ask this question for people, which is super funny because if anybody ever at any time asks me what I'm reading, I'm like, it's about this and it has this in it. I never know. I rarely know the title or the author unless it's somebody that I've read for like a
Yeah,
really, really long
that's
time.
terrible. I will say, I guess 2 books ago, I did listen to, didn't read, but listen to What Made Maddie Run. And I finished it in probably literally a day. It is
Okay.
unbelievable. For anyone that
Okay.
has teenagers and teenage girls, it's a phenomenal book.
All right, what made Maddie run? All right, I love that. All right, very, that's good because parents of teenagers need more support because, like, when you're going through the parenting journey, it's like all the support is like, under age 6 or 8. And then you get to be a teenage parent, you're like, where are my people? Where is the help?
Totally.
Because this is like nailing jello to a tree. I need some help,
With a 16 and a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, we're in the thick of it. So I get it.
You are. Oh my goodness. Yes, you are. Okay. So, thinking about you when you were a teenager, third and final question. Do you remember if you had posters hanging up in your room? And if so, do you remember what one of them might have been?
Oh my gosh, that's a good question. Okay, I think I actually did have one poster. It wasn't a boy band. I was obsessed with the Phantom of the Opera, and I think
Oh,
it was like a poster. I think my parents had taken us to New York to see the Phantom of
nice.
the Opera, and it was a poster from the show. So
I
yeah.
think, yeah, no, I think with the mask.
Yes, that's
Yes.
exactly right.
Yes. That's a fantastic, fantastic memory. That's it. Leslie Jones, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.